I am Elle Penelope, author of epic fantasy and paranormal romance, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Sunday, November 1st, 2020, and this is episode 92 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So this episode is brought to you by the latest from Kensington Books from Rebecca Weatherspoon, If the Boot Fits. Now, Rebecca is a fantastic author. She's one of those authors who I go to when I've kind of been trying out some other things or I've DNF'd some books and I need something solid that I know is going to be good. I'll be like, what does Rebecca have out now? And out now she has If the Boot Fits, which is the second book in her series of Cowboys of California, which takes place on a luxury dude ranch that is Black owned in California. It's sort of a Cinderella-esque story. Now, Cinderella stories are my favorite trope. And this one is about a personal assistant to a Hollywood celebrity who gets treated very awfully by the celebrity. And the hero is an Oscar-winning actor. So we've got Black excellence, we've got Hollywood, we've got horses and ranches. I really enjoyed the first book in the series, A Cowboy to Remember. She made an amnesia plot work, which is really hard, especially in 2020 and in general. That is Stokely doing wind sprints in the hallway. But yes, If the Boot Fits is delightful, it's fun, it's sexy, and it is a wonderful love story to take your mind off of everything happening in the world. And you can get it wherever books are sold or at kensingtonbooks.com. So this week's best thing is I got my new toy, and I actually did the review already, so you might have seen it if you are a subscriber on my video channel, on my YouTube. The FreeWrite Traveler is the newest gadget, writing gadget. So I have some videos on my YouTube channel that are reviews of the original FreeWrite. I talk about my Alpha Smart all the time. And this is, I did the Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign for this when it was announced 2 years ago. I've been waiting 2 years. I checked. It was November of 2018 when I ordered it. And their original shipping date was June of 2019. But you know, things happen. And a lot of times with technology, a lot of things happen. And they kept us up to date with, you know, emails regularly about the factory. And then there was a tariff war with China or something, and they couldn't do anything. And then there was a pandemic. And so lots of things happened before we could get these in our hands. But yeah, I'm really excited about this. I decided that I will do like a soft NaNoWriMo. I'm not going to necessarily check in on the website every day, because I found that that mentally hinders me in strange ways at this point in my life and my writing career. NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, was super helpful early on. And proving to myself that I could write 50,000 words in 1 month was just a revelation. And I do recommend it. But right now where I'm at, it's the structure of it, because my mind likes structure and I want to follow the structure and I want to do the thing the way it's meant to be done, that can hold me back where I am right now. So I do want to write 50,000 words this month. I want to draft my heist novel, and I'm going to do it on my FreeWrite Traveler because I actually enjoy using this thing. It's super fun. I'm not going to abandon my Alpha Smart, I don't think, but I'm going to just see how I do this book on this device. But yeah, check out my review. I'll link it in the show notes if you are interested. My writing update. Another reason why I don't want to do the official NaNo is because I've already started writing. I have several chapters already done, and I've showed them to my agent. So let's take a second to talk about option books, because this book technically is my option. So when I signed the contract with St. Martin's Press for Earthsinger Chronicles, there is an option clause, which means they have basically the first right of refusal on my next work of historical fantasy. We got my option to be as narrow as possible. And so basically, I just have to show it to them first, which I would have done anyway, because it's professional courtesy. And if you enjoy working with your publisher, you don't want to not show it to them. We're doing a proposal. A proposal is 2 to 3 chapters plus the synopsis. And earlier, I guess last week, I emailed my agent and I was like, how long is this synopsis supposed to be? Because mine at that point was like 7 or 8 pages. And she was like, oh, 1 to 2 pages. And I was like, oh. So, I wrote her back, and I guess she could sense my, like, disquiet. And she was like, well, 3 pages is not a deal breaker. And I was like, okay, I think I can do 3. So I got it down to 3 pages. I did the first 2 chapters. I sent it to her. She really liked them. So she sent them on to my editor at St. Martin's. So now we'll just see what she has to say. And there are 3 things that could happen next. She loves it. She offers for it. We go and do the contract and we publish it with them. She doesn't love it. She doesn't offer for it. And then I go on submission to other publishing houses. Or she loves it and she offers for it and I'm not happy with the offer, or something else happens and I choose not to go forward with them. And then I go on submission with other houses. I think those are the options. So it all is incumbent upon what my editor, Monique at St. Martin's, feels about the pages and the proposal and the idea. Now, Monique is incredibly busy. She keeps getting promotions. She just got a new one a couple of weeks ago that I saw come through, and which is fabulous, you know. And she is a Black woman who was an editor at a major publishing house, and she picked me out of obscurity, quite literally. If you haven't heard the story of how I became published with St. Martin's Press, essentially Monique saw my book that was self-published and decided to republish it. So she is just always slammed. And so I don't know how long it's going to take for her to even respond to it. My friends are taking bets on it, but I mean, just taking into account all the things that I'm sure are on her plate, things I can't even imagine are on her plate. We'll see. Like, I have no, I'm kind of expecting not to hear anything back until maybe January. So I was like, well, we'll send it to her and I'll continue writing the book. And so by the time I hear back, I'll probably be done. And then we can take the next steps depending on, you know, whatever of those 3 options have happened. However, she also has very good taste. She just had another book hit the New York Times bestseller list that I saw. And so I'm hopeful that that her good taste will extend to seeing how wonderful this idea is and that she must have it. Anyway, that's basically how options work. That's the stage I'm in right now. I have been nervous about selling on proposal, but considering it is the option and Monique knows me and knows my writing and knows like my work ethic, she knows my schedule, like I turn things in on time or I ask for more time as early as possible in the process. So, you know, it's just a matter of if she thinks she can sell it, if she thinks the book will sell, if she can sell it to her people and the salespeople and all the other things that go into publishing. It's not always about how good the book is. There's the marketing and business concerns that go into it too. Me being me, of course, if I go through this whole process and I don't get any bites from traditional publishing, then I'm perfectly happy to self-publish this, although it will be more difficult. It's not, I don't think it's the ideal self-published book. But then again, I'm not necessarily the ideal self-published author. I still like being hybrid. I still like having the control over certain projects. I like choosing, you know, cover designers and doing cover briefs and having my hands in all of those pies. But the marketing is daunting. And I think for this project, it'd be kind of hard. And since at the moment, it's a standalone with series potential, I wouldn't not self-publish it, but obviously that's not my first choice because I think that it would do better traditional. Now we'll see how the book market is and bookstores, but people are still buying books, you know, like consumers are still buying books, publishers and editors are still making deals. So it's all unknown all the time, but that's where I'm at right now. So yes, NaNoWriMo, write this book, get it drafted, first draft. The other difficult thing about what I just did was I fast drafted the first 2 chapters and then I polished them. And it only took a few days because I actually have been honing this skill for the past couple of years. Then I did want someone other than myself to look at it. So I sent the pages to my brother, and he is currently unemployed. He's an actor, so you know. Nothing's happening right now. So he's got all the time in the world to read. And so I sent the first chapter as soon as it was done. And then he read it. He gave me feedback on it. He really liked it. He had a couple of notes. And then I sent the second chapter. And we had been talking about this book. We've been brainstorming it for the past few weeks or months. And so he knows the basic story of it. And his feedback was, this wasn't the second chapter I was looking for. And I was like, oh. And he goes into why he felt that way and honestly, I do understand where he was coming from. I understand what he was looking for. It was very different from what I was intending to do with the second chapter and from how I think the story needs to progress. And so this early in the game, getting feedback is tough. You know, normally I would just fast draft the entire thing and do a full polished version and then either send a chunk of it once more of it was done, like send a chunk of it to get feedback from my beta readers and my critique partners. And because I knew I was doing this proposal and only doing the first two chapters and getting them polished to send out without having the rest of the story drafted, getting feedback at that stage is really difficult because, you know, it's not even a thing yet. Like, conceivably and probably these chapters will change a lot by the time I get to the end. I knew that I just had to produce, you know, something for my editor to look at, to evaluate, and see if she wanted to buy the book. But it is different than the process that I have sort of fallen into. Like early on, when I was in a critique group and you're writing the book chapter by chapter, and then you're getting feedback chapter by chapter, that's how that works, you know. And I found it helpful at the time, but ultimately, it did not help me write a complete book. And I actually think it might have hurt me. Like, depending on what kind of writer you are, getting feedback on like the micro level before you have the macro level sorted out is hindering, you know, because you're focused on little things when you really need to be focused on the big things, on the structure and the plot and the character development and the arcs and the things that are going to keep people reading. Like, you know, critique groups are often focused on the line edits. And if you're just doing a chapter at a time, you don't need line edits because those lines are going to change, most likely. So I did feel like I needed a sanity check, you know, someone else to read it and be very critical. Of course, my agent read it, and she's not an editorial agent. So she's basing her feedback kind of, it's much more big picture. You know, she has given me great feedback in the past, but it's usually either, I love it, it's amazing, or it's, you know, she will, you know, give me things to work on that are kind of those big picture things. But I do kind of crave that more detailed feedback. And I appreciated it coming from my brother, but it also got in my head. And then I was like, oh my gosh, this sucks. This is terrible. This is not the book that seems like it's going to be. It's not what people are going to be expecting based on the premise and the synopsis. And that really got in my head. And it wasn't even that he didn't like it, you know, it was just that he just was looking for something else. And I knew in my mind that it's just a different expectation and that the, you know, he's kind of looking for a book that I'm not writing. And that's fine. I have to focus on the book that I am writing and on trusting myself and my instincts and my intuition about the story. But getting critical feedback so early in the process when this is still just a baby of an idea, it kind of just messed with my head. So I had to reread my first chapters a couple times until I was sure that I was steeped in the thing I was trying to do. Because he was referencing some other books, and I actually went on Amazon and read the, you know, the free samples of a couple of other books that I consider comps that I don't necessarily want to read right now, like in their entirety and get them in my head. I do want to get the first draft done before I start reading what I think are my comps to make sure that they are actually my comps. But, yeah, so I was reading these books and I was like, okay, yeah, they're really doing something different than what I'm trying to do. I'm focused on it being very like commercial and fast paced. I like to write things that are like ruthlessly plot driven and fast paced. And I think that he really enjoys things that linger a little bit more on the description. Like if you really love to read descriptions, those are not my books. I skim descriptions. I dislike reading descriptions. I have a difficult time creating like the author's version of the space in my mind. I have a version of the space and it's like the bare bones version. And that's really all I need to see. If you're lingering on, you know, the tapestries and the floor tiles and, you know, the description of this and that, I'm bored. and I skip. So I don't put those things generally in my books. I mean, I do try to go back in later drafts and make sure that you actually know like what kind of space this is and give enough. But I've seen, you know, feedback on my books that it's completely valid, that there's not enough description. I don't really talk about what people are wearing in general, unless it's relevant, or, you know, I'll mention it so that you have an idea of, yeah, this person wears dresses instead of pants or vice versa, because it's relevant to the character and the time period and the story and all of that. I'm not a description person. I don't think I'm going to become a description person. And, you know, he really enjoys lingering in the descriptions, and that's totally fine. It's just not the books that I want to write. So it's like this sort of cognitive dissonance of knowing that, like, the feedback is valid for a different book, and I know what I'm doing, and it's not that. But I still kind of want, I want all the things, and you can't have all the things. You can only have the thing that you can have. So that was a challenge from this week. Also, I got the copy edits back for Requiem of Silence, book 4 of Earthsinger Chronicles. I've got about 2.5 weeks to do them. I haven't started yet, but I will start Monday, I think. And so just reviewing the copy editor's comments, making any final tweaks. I had a few notes of things that I noticed or I thought about after I turned in the book. And so I knew that I'd be able to hit them in copy edits, and then we'll see what the copy editor has to say, if there's any weirdness. Usually my copy edits are pretty light, and then it's just a matter of, you know, just those last minute details that I want to make sure I say this and connect this, and did I do this? I don't remember. And it's been enough time and space for me away from the manuscript that I can look at it with fresh eyes, read through it all again, and then move forward. So this is the second to last time I'll see it. I'll get the proof pages, what do they call them? The pass pages or the galleys. And that'll be the last stage once it's typeset. So this book is on its way. This past week on Jeffy Kennedy's podcast, First Cup of Coffee, she was talking one day about something I found really interesting. It was like writing the same idea over and over again. And she was saying how she had done that. She had an image in her mind that sort of sparked several different books. She mentioned another author. I think it was Robin McKinley, who I have never read, but who apparently has done like a Beauty and the Beast story multiple times because she didn't feel like she got it right. And that is actually true for me too, because I have written the same story, well, the same seed idea a couple of times. So only one is published. The idea is a girl falls in love with an invisible boy. And the first book, not the first one, the second one. So when I figured out it was like I was attempting to write a novel. The first one I did when I was back in my ongoing writing workshop was something called Chromatopsia, which was not the story. The second one that I did that I actually took to my first Vivona, and I believe it was the first NaNoWriMo that I ever won, was a story about a girl falling in love with an invisible boy. And it was a YA story. And this was the Vivona Writers Workshop. It was 2013. And it was with Juno Diaz. And I think I've told the story before, how I took the first chapter to the workshop. And it was an amazing, life-altering workshop. Juno Diaz is a genius. He's like a magician. I don't know how he does what he does. But he sort of savaged my first chapter. And I say savage because I'm an artist and I'm very sensitive. But it sort of was an example in the class of some things not to do. And so I had not been able to touch that manuscript again for 7 years, which is fine. It's totally fine. I guess you can call it a trunk novel. But, you know, it was days after returning from that workshop that I did the first draft of Song of Blood and Stone. And so it actually worked out. And I learned so much. I learned so much from that experience, but it was very difficult. And so that story was based on that idea. And then 2 years later, I wrote Angelborn, which is based on the same idea. A girl falls in love with an invisible boy. Completely different stories. There's nothing similar really about them. They're both paranormal. One is YA, one is new adult. But I don't know that I'm done with that idea yet. Like, I think I love Angelborn. I love it whenever I haven't read it in a long time, but maybe I'll read it again one day. I think I did a good job with that story, but it wasn't quite what I had envisioned. You know, it was like you have this this thing, this image or idea, concept, this gem that's in your mind, and you're trying to bring it out into reality. And for various reasons, the characters go this way and that way, and the situation and the story goes this way and that way. And it never is quite that thing that you envisioned. And so I could see myself trying my hand again at that concept and seeing if I could get it right. And the thing is, I know I could never get it right because nothing ever comes out the way that that idea was in your head. Like even the story I'm working on right now. For a long time, you know, all I had was 1920s fantasy heist. That's all I knew. But it existed as a potential book in my mind, and it had sort of a vibe and an energy to it. And I know that the synopsis and the outline I've come up with are nothing like that. You know, like it is still that, but it's also wildly different. And it's really hard to explain, but because I didn't have a story, I didn't have characters, I didn't have anything. I just had like this energy, and the energy of the thing that I've created over the past few months in preparation for actually writing the book is a slightly different energy. And it's different than how I thought it was going to be. I still really like it, but yeah, it's just, that's how creativity works, I think. It, you know, there's some memes about the book that you have in your mind. It's this beautiful castle, you know, and the book that you write, and it's just like shack that's falling apart. And it's not quite that bad, you know, like I don't feel like this is a shack, but it makes a lot of sense because even if I write a really good book that a lot of people like, it's not going to match up to that like pristine perfection that was the originating idea that was in my mind that can never actually become a reality, you know. We get as close as we can to it. And that's the best that we can do. So in research, I am still watching heist things. The TV show Hustlers was recommended to me. Shout out to Effie for recommending that. I watched the first two episodes last night. So it's sort of like Leverage a little bit. It's like the British version. There's five people and they're all criminals and they're doing these heists every week. And she told me that, while Leverage had better characters, Hustlers has better heists, and I can see why. Yeah, it actually does. It's very clever. I sort of figured out what was going on in the first episode, but I still liked seeing it play out. And also, it's not the same tone, because Leverage is very self-aware of how ridiculous it is, and Hustlers takes it a little bit more seriously, while in the second episode, there is a imaginary song and dance routine that's happening in someone's mind that was very cleverly done. Like, I like it. They both have style and flair in their own ways, so that's fun. I watched The Killing, which is a 1956 movie by Stanley Kubrick. It's considered his first like real movie because he did some silent movies before or something. Now, even though I was a film student, I am not a Kubrick fan. I cannot claim that at all. And I'm not a fan of The Killing. I did not like that movie. Now, sometimes it's hard to go back and watch movies, you know, from the 50s and 60s and stuff, because a lot of things don't hold up. So there were some things that bothered me, some like, you know, 1950s misogyny, racism kind of things that bothered me. But I don't think that was why I didn't like the movie. It's listed on, you know, the best heist movies of all time and the best crime films of all time. And it's Kubrick. You know, it's early Kubrick. You can see his things coming forward. I read a little bit about the backstory, and yeah, you know, he was only 28 when they made this, I think. Maybe the thing is, in our modern sensibilities, we want the heist to be successful and the people to get away with it. Heist movies of bygone eras reflect the morality of the time, where crime doesn't pay is the theme. And sorry if I'm spoiling this like 70-year-old movie, but it doesn't end well. Yeah. Is that why I didn't like it? Not even that. Like, but basically, if you're watching a heist movie from before the 2000s, I guess. I could be wrong about this, but this is my general impression. It's not going to end completely well for the participants. I watched The Italian Job again, the new one, and I was going to watch the original with Michael Caine. Then I read the synopsis on Wikipedia, and I read the ending, and I'm like, oh no, I don't need to see that. I'm not in the mood for that right now. I might watch it anyway just to see how they pull it off. But yeah, like the original Ocean's 11 doesn't end well. Not as unwell as The Killing, but you can tell that they're really pushing the morality of crime doesn't pay. which I understand. It makes sense in that time period. There were just other things about that movie that I didn't like. I guess I can appreciate why it's on those lists, and maybe it was groundbreaking, and, you know, the filmmaking and the way he's composing things and its nonlinear structure, which I think was very unusual for that time period too. It's put together well, I'll say that. I didn't enjoy watching it. I didn't enjoy the characters, and I didn't enjoy the ending. So that's a me thing, I guess. It was a good heist, I think. Although the mastermind was not quite as smart as I'm used to, you know, these masterminds being. I guess these days you're like, they think of everything. You know, they think of how things could go wrong. And this plan required everything to go right. A lot of just very complicated things to go right. And some of those complicated things were absolutely insane to think that they would go right. Like, there's literally a man in an open-top convertible pulling out a rifle where anyone could see him to shoot something. Anyway, not my favorite thing. But I will continue on my research because I still don't think that my heist is heisty enough. And as I write it and as I learn more about the characters and as things unfold, I'm sure that I will be able to address that. So that's it for me for this week. This is election week, and I'm going to say it anyway, even though I know it's very possible that it can't possibly happen. I do hope that you have a wonderful week. I hope that we can all have a positive week, no matter the outcome, as difficult as that might be, depending on the outcome of the election. But positive, good energy to all and to our country. And I will talk to you next week. For episode show notes and to sign up for the Footnotes newsletter to get the show notes in your inbox, go to myimaginaryfriendsshow.com. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including Audible, which now has our podcast, and watch the video episodes on YouTube. I would really appreciate a rating or review to help support the show. And My Imaginary Friends is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. For more fantastic podcasts, go to frolic.media/podcasts.